Oh, I miss those guys at the Bluegrass Festival this year. Triple L Band from three young sons. Their mom and dad traveled the country singing bluegrass, and they're from New Mexico. The Triple L Band, and Jesus is the King. 10 minutes past the hour, we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, who is a board member at Creation Moments and a biochemist in his own right, and in fact, the only scientist we have on staff here at Broken Road Radio. And Don, good to talk to you again. We missed you last week. Well, we got to talk to you briefly on the phone, didn't we?
Well, we did, but our internet was completely out. It was out most of the day, actually.
Yeah.
Not that the storm lasted that long, but we had a storm in the morning right before the radio program, and it must have hit our internet tower up on Moon Hill.
Moon Hill, eh? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know you had hills in that part of Texas.
Oh, yeah, we do. Oh, okay. This is a very, very hilly, hilly area, and... Anyway, Moon Hill's the highest point around, and so there's a radio tower, and on the hill, it must have gotten struck by lightning because it was a lightning storm that came through.
Well, what was it like to be back in the Stone Age with no internet?
Well, it's like you are missing your tool. You know,
yeah.
It's like trying to cut out that circular wheel without having any tools whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. We're so used to this. It's amazing how quickly the internet and digital stuff has taken hold. It's been, 25 years? My first touch of a computer was about 1990, and I had no idea what I was dealing with. Had a massive hard drive, 89 megabytes was what it held.
Whoa.
As I recall.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's huge.
I work with files 10 times that size now. So anyway, so goes the modern culture. But we have the internet back, and we're glad to talk to Dr. Don. We're going to learn something here, I think today. The subject is redwood trees and how they may or maybe cannot be used to date the time of the flood. Tell us, Don, a tree, I guess any tree, adds a ring. I mean, if you see a cross section of a tree, you see rings, and you count those rings, and I guess you go down to zero, and you can get back to the how many years that tree has been growing. Correct? Is that accurate to say?
Well, generally, that's
kind of common knowledge, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. In dendrochronologists, actually, they're the ones who date trees, typically, if you have a season. That is, if you have, you know, summer and winter, then you will have a tree ring.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because obviously the tree grows in the summer when it's warm and then slows down tremendously when it's cold and may even almost stop in your part of the country.
Yeah.
But
they head south up here.
Yeah, but you know, if it stays warm the whole year, then you may not get a tree ring because the the growth isn't.
That's interesting.
So the growth is constant.
So the warm season has to end, so the growth stops and then restarts, and that's what creates the ring.
Right,
okay.
Because the darker areas, of course, the lighter areas in the tree are the faster growing.
Mm-hmm.
Cellulose, the tree material.
It's a new layer around the circumference of the tree. I mean, it gets wider.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then the darker area, of course, is when the tree is growing much more slowly.
Okay.
But there are missing rings.
There could be missing rings depending on the climate and depending on what's happening. So if you had a very unusual year, for example, I mean, you know, here's the problem with most of, dating techniques. We look around and we say, what's happening today? And, well, today we have summer and we have winter, and that's pretty well defined. And sometimes it's colder and sometimes it's warmer, and sometimes the summer lasts a little bit longer and sometimes the winter lasts a lot longer. We take those assumptions and we say, okay, that needs to apply back, 50 million years. And you scratch your head and you say, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
If you're logical about it, you have to say, why must the current conditions be the same you know, 50 million years ago, even, you know, 5,000 years ago. And so that's where we can where we can run into trouble.
That's like taking a shortcut, isn't it? That's like avoiding the hard work of science and just say, well, can we all agree to do it this way? And and saves ourselves save ourselves years of research and a lot of money and energy.
Yes. Yeah. That's you know, typically, and you know, for the most part, okay, you know, we do have summers and winters, and the trees are going to lay down, you know, a tree ring. But like I said, if especially after a catastrophe and a global catastrophe, what were the conditions? I mean, you know, we don't know. I mean, in some areas, it could have been warm for a long period of time, and we know in other areas, for example, when we had the Great Ice Age, which I believe, and many creation scientists believe, that was a direct result of the global flood, as we've talked about before in this program. Then, you know, you had periods of long periods of cold weather. I mean, not only cold weather, but cold enough to deposit a lot of snow, which then created a lot of glaciers, which we have evidence, of course, in your part of the country and elsewhere for glacier movement down into the United States, for example, from Canada.
And so, in those years, there would have been no additional ring laid on those trees.
Oh yes, the tree wouldn't have grown very much, and you'd have a pretty dark you know, a thick dark layer in, but you wouldn't have you know, a big fat summer layer, for example, of a white layer where, or lighter colored layer where the you know, tree was growing at a decent decent clip. So take all that to say that while tree rings are the most accurate method we have of dating, there are still you know, some flaws in the technique, and that's the only reason why I bring that up.
Well, the if there was a global flood, that suggests there was a time when there may not have been trees, or at least in large swaths of the earth. I don't know how many trees might have survived and continued life after that flood, because we're talking about a huge a cataclysmic change to the Earth's climate. Is it safe to assume that the flood wiped out all vegetation on the face of the Earth?
Well, I think so, because it was, you know, if you believe the biblical description, the whole Earth was covered with water. And the whole Earth was covered with water probably at least a half of year, if not you know, if not longer, because we know that Noah was, and his family, for example, was were in the ark for a little longer than a year, and so there wasn't any vegetation on the Earth for a good period of time after the flood. And a lot, you know, vegetation is not going to grow, at least trees and, you know, bushes and vines and things like that aren't going to grow in water-soaked soil. You know, the roots need oxygen, and the water doesn't carry enough for, you know, the roots to get enough oxygen for the tree to grow.
If that's true, then that should suggest that there was a time when there was the beginning of trees again, when some of the seeds that survived that climactic change sprouted after the land had dried out and some warmth had returned and the tree had all the elements it needed, a sprout would have come up. And so that suggests there would be like a backward limit to the age of a tree. Now, aren't there people that are saying that there are trees that go back 6,000 years and 9,000 years, some ancient redwoods, for example?
Well, the topic of our discussion today is the giant sequoias in the Sierra Nevadas, in the western coast of California. So the sequoias, for example, it looks like they actually, if you look at the fossil record, and it looks like they were much more greater dispersed across the earth than just California. But today, we see them in California, and we see them in a very restricted area in California. So, you know, the question you got to ask is, okay, why is that to begin mm-hmm. with? And why are the sequoias like, you know, one of the, or if not the oldest trees, why are they the oldest trees? And we don't see a lot of other trees, except for maybe the bristlecone, you know, pines, for example, that even approach the ages of the giant sequoias. And the oldest living giant sequoias have been dated to about 3,200 years or greater. And, you know, the most conservative number is 3,200. Mm-hmm. But the or greater, like I said, could be, you know, another, you know, another 1,000 years on top of that. So they appear to actually have, if you will, recorded the time of the flood, because they would have been wiped out, and apparently were wiped out at the time of the flood. Like,
well, if there are if there's a fossil record that is fossilized redwood, no longer wood, but rather fossils, it's all been replaced by minerals, those fossils would have, well, they wouldn't have happened since the flood, would they?
No. Mm-hmm. No, unless there was a mini flood that mm-hmm. you know, trapped some trees like we like we had about you know, Mount St. Helens, for example. Mm-hmm. There are some trees that are being fossilized, but other than, you know, a little microcosm like that, a catastrophe, yes. Mm-hmm. And having the right conditions, which is mineralized water, mm-hmm. would create a fossil. But
so this suggests that the presence of fossil redwoods suggests that they were present before the flood.
Yes, exactly.
I got you.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you even find you know, sequoia leaves, for example, preserved in volcanic lava. That has, as well as the cones, obviously, you know, went over the area where the trees once were, and you can find these dispersed, like I said, over a wide area. So one of the questions with the giant sequoias is why are they localized in that particular region? And why haven't they spread out further? And why do they seem to be so old? If we've got other trees that, you know, kind of die off a lot younger than the sequoias, why are the sequoias specifically designed, if you will, to seemingly last forever, mm-hmm. As long as you don't have, you know, a catastrophe or something destroying the tree? Now, with all trees will live forever unless something happens to it. And what is that something? Well, you could have insects, of course, you know, infest the tree. And here in the South, we have the pine beetle that can wipe out, you know, a pine grove in a matter of a couple of years. Mm-hmm. Just big beetles that bore into the bark and into the tree, and eventually completely kill the tree. So you can have insects, you can have fire. You know, if there's a forest fire, that can obviously kill and burn, you know, barren trees. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you can have some type of catastrophe that would completely knock the tree down, like storms and stuff like that.
This is the first I've heard that a tree really would last forever were it not for parasites, insects, climactic disasters like fires that would take it out. I figured that some had life cycles. I know that up here in our birch trees and our poplars, typically you lose them every 30 years or so. But again, there are a lot of insects that attack those trees. So,
right, a lot of insects, fungal diseases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of love. In fact, that's typically the way a birch goes down, is it's attacked by fungus.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Those type of diseases, you know, will take down a tree, other than if you could preserve that, or if you could have a tree that was resistant to those things, then you might have a tree that would last, you know, for actually would last forever. Unlike us, we have a programmed clock within us, and when our clock is up, even if we're healthy as a horse, assuming a horse is healthy, you know, we don't live forever because our DNA is programmed now to have only a certain number of replications in it, and once that is up, then the DNA doesn't replicate anymore. But that's not true of trees. Now, what's so special about the redwoods? Well, the redwoods have a natural preservative in their wood that is highly resistant to insects and highly resistant to fungal infections. And, you know, that's why if you built a house out of wood, you would like to choose redwood, because you don't have to treat that. I mean, now we have, you know, we use pine a lot because it's fast growing, but we treat it with chemicals in order to prevent it from being chewed up by insects, or prevent it from, you know, getting fungal infections and then, you know, rotting, if you will. But the redwoods are different in that they, you know, you can cut a redwood, make planks out of it, and that redwood plank is going to last you a very, very, very long time because, it, like I said, it is immune to those type of things. So if the wood structure itself is immune to insects and fungal diseases. And then the bark of a sequoia, for example, can be 24 to 31 inches thick, and it's quite spongy. It acts almost like asbestos, that it just doesn't burn, and being so spongy, it absorbs water, so it's got its natural built-in fire extinguisher, if you will, in the bark. So a fire, once a tree gets a certain size, fire is not going to hurt a giant sequoia. And it might scorch the outside of the bark, but it would have to be a very, very intense fire to bring down a redwood.
So that then also explains how they get to be giants, 30 feet in diameter, that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Because, like I said, you know, they just continue to grow, and year after year after year, they just get, you know, bigger around. You know, of course, most of the branches, if you look at one of these old trees, for example, they don't have branches close to the ground. Their branches are way up at the top of the tree, and there's not a lot of branches, but you know, there's some up there, and there's obviously you need sunlight and you need leaves in order to produce the cellulose and the sugars needed in order to for the tree to grow. And so once the, you know, once even the branches get above fire level, for example, those, you know, they're not going to burn, and they're going to, you know, survive any type of forest fire that would come through the area. Well. So you have these old, very old trees, but obviously they had a starting place, because why don't we find any trees older than, you know, 3,200 years or 4,000 years in these areas? And so, I mean, that event or that point in itself says, well, there must have been some type of catastrophe that took these trees out, because we know that insects not going to do it, and fungal diseases aren't going to do it, and you know, fire is not going to do it. So what you're left with is a massive catastrophe of, let's say, water, and that water had to rush in with such force that would actually take these trees down. And that's exactly what we have with the flood, for example, because at the time of the flood, the global flood, it looks like we had tsunamis, that we had tremendous earthquakes, we had tsunamis. You know, nothing as small as the tsunamis that we have today, and we've had some pretty big tsunamis. But we're talking about tsunamis in the 600 to 800 foot, you know, category that swept across the Earth's surface. And I mean, with, even with the 100 foot tsunamis that, you know, Japan and some of the Asian, you know, countries have had, or 50 feet. They cause tremendous damage and can completely, you know, strip mm-hmm. the land, if you will, of anything in its path. Well, you know, take that and multiply it by, you know, factor of 10. That's the type of thing that apparently was happening at the time of the flood. So it's no surprise that even the giant sequoias would not survive something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be interesting to have a tree, you know, that was 6,000 years old or 7,000 years old, for example, that could have survived. But unfortunately, we don't have that. But we do have these trees, for example, that did, you know, did survive. At least it looks like they were planted, some of them, you know, 3,200 plus years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting that there's this kind of a perceived start to the redwoods, or a restart of the redwoods, and combined with evidence that there used to be redwoods before that, there's just this line of demarcation suggests a pretty strong evidence for, as you say, a flood or a cataclysmic, a global kind of event to have wiped out those trees worldwide. But it also suggests that before the flood, I mean, what must forests have looked like? We've talked a number of times on this program about the uniformity of the climate previous to the flood, or prior to the flood, where much more of the earth was warm and conditions were perfect for growing. There must have been gigantic trees and other plant life in those days. I mean, there was nothing to stop them.
Well, exactly. And they're tremendous forests, you know, during that antediluvian period. Mm-hmm. There had to be tremendous forest, had to be you know, animals growing larger than they grow today because of the environment being, you know, perfect for their growth as well. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, totally different picture than what we have today.
And people living longer.
And people are absolutely living slightly longer. Mm-hmm. I mean, only 900 plus years. Yeah. So
drop in the bucket.
That in itself, you know, is hard to imagine, because obviously our lifetime is limited. Mm-hmm. And okay, we have people that live over 100, but not many. And you know, Moses, as recorded in the Bible, for example, lived 120 years. But Noah, you know, lived well over 500 years, and you know, even his sons lived a very long time. And they obviously, Noah was born before the flood, but they you know, went through the flood, and then their lifespan, man's lifespan, decreased very, very rapidly after the flood. But the another interesting thing about these redwoods is that in order to propagate, the seeds have to land in very rocky soil, if not on the cliffs of a mountain, for example, where there isn't much nutrients, but it has to be a diluvian soil. It has to be soil that was put there by a flood. And we know this because there was a flood back in 1880s, and a new grove of redwoods, or these sequoias, were started after this flood. And that's the only area where new growth has started since the beginning of these giant sequoias.
Interesting.
So, you know, there is, that brings in the element that in order to start these trees up, you had to have these specific type of conditions. And I guess the main area where that existed was on in the Sierra Nevadas, and they obviously needed a flood, and the seeds need to be in moist soil for a period of time, and the soil can't be too rich or otherwise the seeds don't germinate properly. And the seeds have to be in this very rocky condition.
Well, it seems like an ideal place for that would be mountainous terrain near a coast.
Well, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which is where we see the redwoods.
Of course, that mountainous terrain, post flood, wouldn't have developed until the mountains developed.
Mm-hmm.
And the mountains, the mountains developed after the continent split up, post flood, and then started having plate movement, for example, under the western coast of Americas, and mm-hmm. that then pushing up the mountains such as the Sierra Nevadas.
And we talked about that on the program too. The Pangaea, the single mass of Earth, a single continent on the Earth, was broken up by that flood, and gave us the tectonic plates that we now experience and can observe. How do evolutionists handle this information about this kind of a dateline or a deadline for the age of redwoods?
Well, it's difficult to explain, mm-hmm. unless you have a catastrophe, mm-hmm. and not just a local catastrophe, but a global catastrophe. Because you can't really explain the disappearance of redwoods, like, say, in the middle of the United States, for example, or even over in Europe, unless they were completely wiped out at the same time with, a global flood.
Mm-hmm.
So it always amazes me. The evidence, seems always to point to a global flood. But the folks just refused to acknowledge that such a thing actually happened in Earth's history. Mm. And I think it's more of a spiritual problem and more of a than anything else, because, our eyes are blinded, to these simple logical, conclusions if you don't know the creator of the universe. Mm-hmm. And if you don't believe that there was a creator of the universe, then the simple fact that, okay, there was a global flood, what started the flood, man's sin ultimately came to such a point that man's thoughts were evil continuously, and God said, hey, I gotta start over, this is a problem. Hence, the conditions. It's interesting because if you think about this, even when God was brooding over his creation, for example, before he said, let there be light, as written in Genesis 1, verse 2, he knew that the flood would happen. And it wouldn't surprise me, obviously, since he is the creator, that he put the time frame of the global flood, he built that in, if you will,
mm-hmm.
And all of the conditions that were necessary for the flood, whatever started it, and some folks think, well, there was a giant meteor that hit the Earth and that kind of started things, and maybe that's true. I don't know. Maybe it was Mars that came into close, proximity with the Earth and started breaking up the continents. That's speculation, and we can run, energy calculations to see if it's got enough energy. to do that, if you get the moon close enough to the Earth, it would have enough energy possibly to perturb, but it would have to repeat it, over several cycles, mm-hmm. if you will, around the Earth, and then eventually the moon would have had to drift off a little bit further from the Earth to stop the process. Whatever the process was that started the global flood, I truly believe that God, put that into place, and since He knows the beginning or the end from the beginning, and the beginning and the end, He is the Alpha and Omega. Then it wouldn't be hard for Him to know that man is going to become very, very evil, and He would have to do something at a certain point in time.
This also serves to point out another view of the flood. So many times we read it this way in Genesis, that it was done to punish man, but in fact it was done to save the species, wasn't it? Because we would have destroyed ourselves.
Yes, and that that brings up a character of God that is consistent, and that's His overpowering grace, if you will, and His overpowering love, for man and mankind. It was man who was destroying himself. Mm-hmm. It wasn't God who was destroying man before the flood. It was man. And if God had allowed that to continue, there wouldn't have been any man left on earth, anyway, if you will. Mm-hmm. But, God, as is written in a kind of a poetic way, at least, God, looked around and said, I've got this one righteous man, Noah. And so, therefore, I'm going to work with Noah. Well, it reads as if he, by the way, there's Noah. I guess I can't wipe out Noah, but I can wipe out everybody else. Of course, God knew that there would be a righteous man, and He, knew that it was Noah, and his great-great-grandfather was Enoch, whom he took up. Enoch wasn't on this earth for 900 years. He was on the earth for 300 so years, and the only reason why he didn't die, it was because he was so righteous that God says, "Hey, okay, come on up. You can join me." Mm-hmm. So he was one man, but Noah is a descendant of Enoch, so of that righteous man, as well as Methuselah, for example. So Noah was of a lineage of righteous folks, and as the man became utterly deprived or depraved, if you will, in his behavior and his thinking, there still was this thread of righteousness running through
that mankind. Brings up yet another other side of the coin point of view here, that is, that if sin runs in our DNA, so then does righteousness.
Well, right, absolutely, and righteousness, of course, comes from God, and it is that that hope of righteousness. It's not that we are righteous in and of ourselves, but the righteousness actually is a remnant of God living within us.
Well, that's the image of God that has been built into us. I mean, that's got to be eternal good in each of us, and the matter is just not letting it become destroyed by a flood of iniquity, I suppose you could put it. It's almost like the pattern is repeated within each human being that the earth has gone through. It's just rebirth and being born again and all that all weaves together, and just a great story of existence here. And we learned a little bit about it this morning. Anything else on the redwoods? If there'd been no flood, we would have been an uninhabited earth except for the redwoods, I think, David. I suppose.
Just trees. and maybe someday two of the redwoods would get together and say, we should have a radio show. I was looking at a couple of other pages while you guys were talking about redwoods and Noah and Methuselah and all that stuff. And there are other redwoods in the rest of the world in other areas. But they've been transplanted, or they've been, some guys have, back in the 19th century have picked up seedlings or seeds and then transplanted. There are some in Scotland, for example, and a number of a small forest in England, and one of the largest, the tallest sequoia outside the United States is in France. It's 191 feet. It's 158
years old. I've never seen our redwoods. I'd like to do that.
Oh yeah, it's a very spiritual experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult not to think, ooh. Somebody created this. Ooh, there's intelligence here. It's just you can't do that. I mean, you can't not think that when you're sitting in the middle of the redwood forest and you know there's just kind of the gentle swaying. Other interesting thing that I found out too is we were talking about using redwoods as construction material, and they're not used in buildings all that much because the wood is very brittle. And you know, there's a mention in there that redwoods are not forested; they're not cut down to use all that much because most of the wood is lost when the tree comes down. I mean, it splinters.
Yeah,
I've
worked with it. It's not used for buildings, it's used on decks and so forth because you don't need the strength for those structures. But it's very useful wood.
It's strong wood, but it's also very brittle, and when it there's an early logging technique that they would build a large ditch, and then fill it with tree branches to soften the blow.
Mm-hmm.
But they would still lose something like 50% of the wood.
Wow,
and would be useless to commercial processes.
Okay. Well, we've been talking about an article that's on the pages, the website of the Institute for Creation Research, and we will have a link in it in our podcast so that you can. Download the podcast or listen to it on the site and follow that link and read the article for yourself. If you'd like to just go straight to the article, their website is icr.org. You can go there and search for Redwoods and Flood, for example, and it'll pull up this article for you. It's by the article is by Dorothy. I've got your picture in the way here. I got to move this. It's by Dorothy Christ Robbins, and it's in their botany section. They have quite a library, quite a collection of literature, scientific information for the most part on the young earth creationism. I think you find the site interesting. And again, for those of you who can't accept this kind of thing, that say, no, evolution is the law of the land, all I can say is, look at this with an open mind and really judge by the value of the science that you read there. You could start at that point at the science and then decide for yourself whether what you read is valid information. But I think this is a very, very persuasive. Dr. Don, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's I really enjoy reading articles from the Institute of Creation Research. Of course, we have several articles on our website, too, mm-hmm. Creation Moments. The Institute of Creation Research is more a lot more scientific.
Mm-hmm.
You can find some very well-written scientific papers on the site under various topics, and I would point people to the rate study that was done a number of years ago, talking about radioisotopic dating and how come it looks like the Earth is millions and millions of years old mm-hmm. by isotopic dating. And they go through and explain all of that. You can, research that.
And there aren't a lot of people willing to say that out loud either. I mean, because there's a price you pay for going against the current here. I'm looking at some articles listed in their pages. Plants use underground fungal internet to communicate. Complex bioengineering in blooming flowers, shocking evidence of electrical signals in plants. So there's kind of a specialty about how plants talk to each other. And I suppose the redwoods do that too. And you can link to this article. You can also link to creationmoments.com from this article, from the podcast, or just on our website at brokenroadradio.com, where you're likely listening this morning. Don, thank you so much. Appreciate the time you spend every week, and it's just a treasure having you with us.
Oh, well, thank you. And we'll see you next week.
We'll look forward
to it. Sounds good.
See you then. Bye-bye.
Look forward to it.